The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about what happens when something that seems like a great thing at first goes to the dark side and takes you with it. I'm your host, Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm also your host, Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy. Sarah and I met, fell in love in a, quote, self-help organization that turned out to be a mega cult called Nexium. Heard of it? We got out of there together, and on our way out, we helped shut it down. Our journey as Nexium whistleblowers was captured in detail on a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, and also on the front page of a newspaper.
New York Times, babe.
Right.
Have you heard of it? Each week on A Little Bit Culty, we talk with other former cult members and whistleblowers, plus experts in things like cultic abuse and coercive control.
We also turn the mic over to advocates and clinicians with wisdom to share on recovering from everything from MLMs and toxic religion to bad romances with raging narcissists.
There's always something to learn about the cultiverse. Be sure to subscribe to A Little Bit Culty so you don't miss an episode. Find us on Instagram and at alittlebitculty.com.
Welcome back, everybody. Who do we got today, Sarah?
We have a very exciting guest, but before we get into that, I have a little bit of housekeeping.
Oh, boy.
First of all, everyone, thank you so much for entering our t-shirt contest. I cannot believe the demand for Vanguard Week t-shirts.
I'm sad to see them go a little bit. They've been collecting dust in my closet for a while.
We have about 15 of them. Between Nippy and I, the only problem is that mine are like extra small and Nippy's are extra large. So I can't guarantee for those who won t-shirts, congratulations. You lucky winners.
Sarah wanted to sell them on eBay.
I would never sell them
no,
on eBay.
We should do a contest. She's like, Nippy, I can get thousands for these. And I was like, Sarah,
no,
it's not about money.
The opposite happened. But I'll let you guys be the judge of that. Speaking of judge, we had our first incident on our social media this week of having to block somebody. And I wanted to just say it here that we don't like to do that. And we're totally happy to have people on our Instagram, social media, Twitter, who don't agree with us, who have alternate opinions to us, who question us. Totally no problem. Blocking, I've always said in the past, can be a little bit culty. If you don't agree with somebody and you just block them, that's not cool. But we also have personal boundaries about being treated respectfully and having civil discourse on our platforms. Anything you want to say about that, Nippy?
I agree with you.
Great. So interestingly, of all the groups that we've covered, we've never been fair gamed by the Scientologists, by the Mormons, by the J-Dubs. Nobody. I mean, people, you know, have been upset, but no one's fair gamed us. We, this week, definitely noticed that the Teal tribe is not happy with our coverage of her. And fair enough, I get it. But the vitriol and the character assassination that we've been under was quite alarming.
It wasn't that alarming. It was about two or three people.
Okay, well, I was alarmed. No, I wasn't alarmed. You're right. It was more just like, we're at a stage in our lives where we don't need to deal with that. It's not about blocking to cancel. It's about blocking when people are going to insult us and attack our character. So it needed to be said.
Some of the letters you got personally, I think, sounded a lot like how we used to sound.
Yeah. So I get it. Like, you know, we've been there. But I think what's interesting about this particular series is that the people who follow Teal, who are loyal to Teal, are telling us how everything was taken out of context and that it was all editing and that's not what the retreats are like. And they're unwilling to look at, you know, the stuff that might be bad or maybe unhealthy. And interestingly, the people that have left and journalists and people who are following Teal felt that the series was softball and they didn't even address some of the more egregious allegations against her and they wondered why. So we have both sides here.
Which may have some upsides too, because you just don't want to club people over the head who are getting ready to get out of a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
And hopefully it planted enough seeds for people to make an informed decision.
Yes, totally. And point being, I feel like we've covered her enough. We're moving on. We're moving on to other cults.
See ya, Teal.
See ya. Good luck with it all. I wish you all the best. Love and light. Namaste. So,
All right.
Our guest today is named Spencer Schneider, and he's the author of Manhattan Cult Story, a nightmarish cautionary tale about an ultra-secret organization that has allegedly engaged in forced adoptions, arranged marriages, public humiliation, forced labor, all under an oath of total secrecy and under the control of a brilliant but demented cult leader posing as a teacher of ancient knowledge. It's a gripping, page-turning, and creepy read.
Spencer Schneider's not a novelist. He lived the pages of Manhattan Cult Story for nearly 23 years. After being recruited into a secret society known simply as School, led by a charismatic and some say sociopathic actress, Sharon Gans, who passed away in January of 2021. School counted some hundreds of well-educated and well-heeled New Yorkers as fervent followers.
He writes, "We were your accountants, your money managers, lawyers, executive recruiters, and doctors. We owned your child's private school and sold you your brownstone, but you'd never guess our secret lives. Now we lived in a kind of silent terror and fervor, and there were hundreds of us."
Spencer joins us to share more about his journey back from the brink and what he wants you to know about School now. Without further ado, Spencer Schneider, cult survivor and author of Manhattan Cult Story.
Spencer Schneider.
Hello.
Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, finally.
I feel like I've been living in your head for the last 48 hours.
I'm thrilled to be here. Very excited to be here.
I just have to tell you, normally when we prep a podcast where someone's written a book, one of us reads the book and the other person doesn't, so that we can ask different questions and come at it from like knowing and not knowing.
No, we both read your book.
I insisted that Nippy read your book.
I tore through it.
Because, I mean, partly just because it's such a good book, but also because there's so many similarities, and I always find it very healing to make the correlations and see the pattern in someone else's group and be able to like go through that with somebody else. I think it's always cathartic, and I thought it would be also helpful for Nippy, which I think it was.
Yes, it was for sure. It's always good to hear people's interpretation of the similar abuses and put language to it, because language is all we have, really. And so the way Sarah describes something, maybe I describe something and you describe something, are different perspectives of the same abuse. And it always deepens my understanding of it when I did articulate it in a certain way. So I got that from your book for sure.
That's great. That means so much to me. First of all, I'm totally honored to be on this podcast with you guys, because I'm in awe of what you did. It's also good, you know, I feel like related to you because we went through something similar, so similar. It's good. It gives me hope for myself and for everybody else who's been in situations like this. So I think when people listen to this, they'll hear similarities, you know?
For sure. Undeniable.
I do feel that family relation, but not in a culty way. Not in a like, oh, you're family, now I'm going to love bomb you. Also partly like the secular Jewish background, the sort of overall desire for more, you know, more meaning, connection with people, community, which actually leads me right into the first question. What did you think you were getting involved with? What was the hook for you? One of the things I really loved was the step-by-step, which you don't have to do here on the podcast, but you really brought the reader, you brought us through that process of, you weren't like, sure, I'll do that. Like you said, no at first. Then you kind of felt bad that you should maybe just give it a try.
Right.
Right.
Obviously, like the premise of this whole thing is that it was secret. This group was secret. And it was presented to me, well, as an esoteric school where people could come to develop themselves along a ancient body of thought that went all the way back to Plato. So it wasn't just presented to me that way out of nowhere. I had known this guy named Bruce for a few months, and he was a bartender at a bar where my band was playing. I was 29 years old. I was a lawyer. I was working really hard in a law firm. I had no social life really, other than playing in a band at this point, because I was just, you know, I was working 80 hours a week. You remember what it was like when you were 29. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're ambitious and, you know, you want some fun. And I really wasn't looking for anything at this point, but I was looking for some fun in the sense of playing in my band. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, he was the bartender at this bar. We became friends. We chatted. He was a very impressive guy. You know, he was Ivy educated twice. He was in architecture school, smart, really good looking guy. He started asking to get together and have coffee and have lunch. And he seemed to be pursuing me It was a little weird, but, you know, I was interested in being nice. And then finally one night he said, look, let's meet. I got to tell you something. I said, okay, fine. You know, I was suspicious, but I was curious. And I met him and I could see how nervous he was. And he said, look, I have to tell you something. He said, look, this is something very special. I've never told anybody this before. I'm involved in, you know, this esoteric school. And we had been talking along for, you know, a few months about like Plato and philosophy and Shakespeare and art and music and things that I'm interested in.
He vetted you already.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally vetted
me. Which you found out later.
Which I found out later.
Yeah.
But they had a very specific, sophisticated method to both vet and lure and to keep it secret. So he swore me to secrecy. He said, would you like to come to this group? You know, it meets a couple nights a week. I think you'll get a lot from it. It changed my life. You know, I get now more what I want out of life. I said, no, thank you. This sounds like a cult.
Did you actually say the word cult?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was so offended.
Wow.
That he would think that I would fucking go to his stupid little cult. I was so angry. I practically stormed out of there. And as soon as I got outside, I felt so bad because he was so nice about it. He was just telling me about this thing. And, you know, I felt guilty. And, you know, here I am being, you know, an obnoxious New York lawyer. And I called him up. I said, okay, fine. You know, let's meet. Tell me more about it. And he told me more about it. He said, just come for a month. You know, it's not a big deal. It's for free. And I said, fine. So what happened was, he said, before you come, he said, it's not for everybody, may not be for you, but before you come, I'd like you to meet somebody else. I said, fine. So a couple nights later, we met at this very trendy restaurant. And I was like, who are we meeting? He said, a friend. He wouldn't really tell me anything. And all of a sudden, this very attractive woman comes over, taps him on the shoulder. They hug and they kiss. And she sat down. And all of a sudden, I'm interested. He knew that I was interested in, you know, meeting women because I was single at the time. And they brought the nicest, hottest babe that they could. She wasn't like hitting on me or coming on, but I'm thinking, you know, if there's more like her at the group, I'll go. Now, by the way, Sarah, Nippy, does this make me sound shallow and stupid?
No,
I don't think so.
No,
this is what
it's a normal
thing. I was 29. If somebody did this to me again today, I'd show up at the meeting.
Can I share something that I noticed about that meeting
Please.
From your book?
Yeah.
Is that when she sat down, she pumped your tires or edified you and said, oh, Bruce told me wonderful things about you. So you then were inflated, love bombed or whatever. You were instantly, you got your first hit of validation, in this case, an attractive woman. This is really when it began right there. That's what I noticed.
That's right. I felt good.
Yeah.
It was like a stranger.
No, they
like,
found your hook.
It was amazing.
And we were taught to do that also. Right? In Nexium, like, I don't think we had it written down in the same way, but we were definitely trained in the exact same way to recruit, which included vetting to a certain degree, but also connecting with the person and building rapport with them and getting into their world and having them feel good and safe and comfortable. I still think that Keith spent some time in this group or knew people that spent some time in this group because the similarities and the strategies were mind-blowingly similar. So you say you're going to do this class. And you get involved and you do your month. What causes you to stay past your month? What was so great there that made you stay? Was it when you lost your job and then?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm summarizing a little bit. So you lose your job and you show up and then this group of people, and I really felt this. I was like, this group of people rallied around you and supported you in a way you've never experienced before. How good that must have felt.
Exactly. Like I wasn't inclined to return after the first night. And I only went because out of an obligation. But like you said, I lost my job and I was completely embraced by these people in a way that, you know, nobody in your life would really do. In a public way also. It was a room with 60 people and they're basically strangers. And they really are being nice to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really were.
Mm-hmm.
Their motivations for the leaders were awful, but the rest of the members were genuine and you felt it. So how could I not check this out? And it was a crisis period because I needed to start a new business and they were very clear that they were going to help me spiritually and emotionally with this goal that I had, which was to open a new practice. Bad timing.
And bad timing for you, good timing for them, because they hooked a big fish. They got a lawyer. And if you could just backtrack for a second, And all of these details I found so rich in the book, like the way that you painted the backdrop of Manhattan with the music and the sounds and the smells and just the whole vibe. Like I felt really transported there. And I thought that was great, including your first time going up to the secret space in the fabric house in the industrial area with an elevator and a crank. And which, by the way, first red flag, right? Like if you're going to a secret space where you have to take an elevator with a crank, that maybe this is something you should look into more, right? Like for our listeners, right? Totally. No judgment. Yes. Listen, no judgment from us.
I gotta say, I get it. If I'm 20, I'm gonna check it out. And I'm gonna check it out under the guise of, I'm just gonna see what this is. I'm not gonna spend
exactly
a year, two, five, 10 in this thing. And that's the thing. That's the thing that I think everyone can kind of relate to with this is like, yeah, I'm in New York. I'm young. I'm gonna go just... what does this button do? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it wasn't a big ask. No. I mean, they weren't asking for money.
Right.
And I'll check it out, you know, and there's no obligation. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
The people who recruited me, they seemed to have this intense connection. I was like, I want that, you know?
I get it. Like for me and Doss, like the thing that was appealing was like, there is something exciting about being a part of a secret group. And Amanda Montell talks about that in Cultish. You know, it's like the secret club. That's a thing from childhood to be a part of a secret club that people don't know about. Like there's a real draw for that for, I think, exclusive. For a lot of people.
It's exclusive.
And you're, it's exclusive.
And there's a crank, you know, what are you going to do? So I really loved how you painted the picture of how the community, well, and by community, I mean, well, first of all, it's secret. So like outside of school, you didn't acknowledge each other. You weren't allowed to fraternize without the leader's permission, direct permission. But in class, when you showed up, the community aspect of the support and the business dealings, like when things were good, what was good about it?
Okay, a lot was good about it. And let's go back to secrecy and exclusivity. I was a lawyer. And a lot of people there had, you know, fancy jobs and they had this, they had that. I think everybody loved the secrecy of it. The reason for the secrecy was very diabolical. We'll get to that later on. But it was born of the paranoia of the leaders, who, by the way, we did not meet for a year. We did not meet the leader for a year. But what drew us together was the secrecy, which required us not to talk to each other outside of the group. We didn't know each other's last names. I didn't have any phone numbers. After class, which met at a secret location, and you couldn't tell anybody in your life about this. I mean, if somebody asked me where I was going tonight, I would just make up some story. I wasn't married, but there was people who didn't tell their spouses where they were going. Mm-hmm. And that created a lot of problems. But I could only see these people who I got to like in class. So that was really a big thing. I wanted to see this one and that one, and I hear their stories, and I was excited to see them and could only see them then. They have a monopoly over these friendships. They control these friendships, and I was fine with that.
How was that enforced?
Purely by insisting, convincing us that it was for our best interests to keep it secret and that nobody outside of the school would understand what you're doing. And that it's an esoteric school, which by definition is secret. And so that it would just, you know, ruin your experience if you told anybody about it.
By the way, that in and of itself is a thought-stopping cliche if you've been following our interview with Amanda Montell. Like, oh, it's an esoteric school. And esoteric by definition means secret. So therefore it's secret. Like it doesn't actually mean anything. Like we've just decided it's an esoteric school. Esoteric by definition means secret and only understood by a small portion of society. So therefore it is secret. But like, what makes it an esoteric school? You know what I mean? Like that's, it's circular. It doesn't actually answer, but why is it an esoteric school, right?
Because we said it is.
Because we said it's an esoteric.
Because we said it is.
Yeah.
Because we said it is, and it suits our purposes of operating under the radar.
Right.
And also it asserts another purpose, which is it isolates you from people who you would ordinarily tell everything about, and it creates fissures in relationships with the rest of your world.
Keeping the secret has natural fissures and ripple effects.
Correct.
Right?
It has to. There's no way. There's no way to have that without affecting your relationships. And that is something that I think is such a clear red flag in our episode with Alexandra Stein, who wrote Terror, Love, and Brainwashing, if our listeners remember. That was one of her key things. The leaders isolate you from your friends and family. That's like the first step, right? And this is also just to draw the parallel with Nexium. In our mission statement, we had a line of, I will no way speak of them or give others knowledge of them outside of...
The information is confidential and for my use only.
The information is for my use only. I will no way speak of it or give others knowledge of it outside of ESP. So that it had that tenet in the mission statement, but then people would always say, you know, at the end of the 5-day when we're supposed to bring people in, they'd be like, so I'm not a secret, but how do I bring people in without talking? Like, people are always confused. It's a total counter command, like two totally different things. Well, then they'd say, well, we want you to share your success and bring people in, but you can't tell them what you're doing here.
You can't teach them the tech.
Basically, they said, we don't want you to teach the tech because A, you're not trained. B, you're going to water it down. C, you could hurt somebody.
Right. All these things they said to us.
The argument was you compromise the integrity of how the inductive nature of our curriculum.
The inductive nature. Like you wouldn't invite someone to a movie and tell them the ending, right? So you can invite someone to a movie, but you don't tell them what the movie's about. You just say, come, trust me. That's how that was sort of justified in our group.
Okay, so that's total red flag.
Right.
I believe that. Didn't you believe that, Sarah? Like,
No, absolutely. We all believed it.
I believed it.
Yeah.
You know, it's step by step. Yes, right. It's not all of a sudden. And I resisted the idea of secrecy when they first heard it, but it started to make sense. And they always said, verify that this works for you. If it doesn't work for you, go. But you have to verify it. And, you know, they get you to enforce it, Nippy. Because they make you think it's in your best interest. And it was that simple. So that's how they enforced the secrecy of it. You know, if people broke the rule, they had to come in and do, what did you guys do? A breach statement or something like that. We had to do a public confession in front of 60 people. And it was humiliating. And you were required to be truthful about everything, which, of course, which is only for your benefit. You know, like, for instance, if after class, there was a guy in class who after class walked with one of the women after class, right? And started like, let's go out for a drink. Okay. So she came back to class the next night and reported him for breaking the quote hour of silence, which you needed to keep after every class. Wow. These were all really smart people who I respected. Mm-hmm. And if I ever had doubts, I just had to look over and look at, you know, Mark or Karen or whoever was there and see that they were doing the same things and they were following the protocol. I figured, why not? It's good enough for them. It's good enough for me.
Right. I think Nexium did the same thing. They used certain people to give the group validity, you know, especially once Hollywood was sort of roped in and a lot of subtle name dropping. And for sure, when you're in a group where you look around and you relate to the people around you, that makes you feel like, okay, if they're getting it, then if I'm not getting it, maybe something's wrong with me, I'm going to get it.
Well, there's a culture of fear that was created, it sounds like.
Yeah.
It was a very concentrated culture of fear. That's why Keith wanted people to move to Albany, because he would create it there. But when we would leave that purview, Sarah, it was looser reins. But yours felt like your only relationship in the class was in that culture. And then when you left that culture, you didn't have that dynamic.
Yeah, there was no way to get away from them because, look, we met two nights a week and then it became more and more nights a week as the time went by. And I eventually got married to somebody in the group. And then my biggest client was in the group. So I was surrounded by it all the time.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And these were true believers who were extremely devoted. And to this day, they're both of those people are still in the group.
Wow.
In the cult.
That's still wild.
It was all encompassing. We never got away. You couldn't get away. You had people calling you every day to check in on you. We were required to check in on other people. There was no physical getting away or mentally getting away.
Yeah. It seemed like, we'll get into this more later, but the leaders really, in creating marriages, not only created marriages and partnerships that weren't healthy, like for various reasons, like weren't good fits, especially when you had a child with your wife and she wants to stay. And then this is a red flag for later, but I have just have to say it now so I don't forget. When she then promotes Beth to a higher, in our situation would be a higher rank than you. I mean, that was just so unhealthy. And also that happened at a time when you guys were considering leaving.
Yeah.
Right? That happened in our group too. When that coup happened, when Nippy and I left with a bunch of people, there were people who were on the fence who were like, wait, branding? What? And some of those people got huge promotions and jumped stripes, right? And got big rank promotions and like were put on payroll and given a bunch of money. And like they were basically bribed. you know, and that's what they did to your wife, right? They bribed her to stay. Yeah,
that's exactly.
Tell us the first major, and the thing that I clocked in reading your book, and I don't know if this is right, but when you got accused of lying, can you tell us the Over the Rainbow, the Over the Rainbow song moment? Because that was my first time I was like, oh dear, here it goes.
So the first moment was we were preparing for a Christmas party. And by the way, just so you know, Christmas party is ironic since all of the leaders were Jewish of this group. And it was kind of, and most of the people in the group were Jewish. I think half Jewish and half Irish.
Oh, interesting.
Right. We're planning a Christmas party. And some of us, you know, we were all assigned different tasks and supposed to do different things.
Right.
And mine was to be the DJ.
Yeah.
One of the leaders there had asked me to come up with a list of songs. And I gave her the list of songs and she saw on it Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And she said, that song shouldn't be on there. Fred, who was one of the teachers, hates that song. He told you not to put that on there. He didn't. So I said, he didn't.
You knew that he didn't.
He never said a damn word about anything.
Right, right.
He never told me what to put on there or what not to put on. I just came up with a list. And I thought Somewhere Over the Rainbow was a nice song, I guess. Who knows? Anyway, she freaked out because it was on the list. And then she freaked out even more because I denied having been told that it was on the list because I hadn't been told about it. Well, she in the classroom shrieked, liar, to call me a liar. And I'm like denying that I'm lying. And as I'm denying, she went even crazier and crazier and got so angry. And it was so embarrassing and humiliating. You know, one of the tenets of the work, which is what we studied, which is the fourth way Gurdjieff work, was that other people see us better than we see ourselves.
Right.
We're always wrong in respect to our next step. And that especially teachers and leaders, older students, can see us better than ourselves. And so this is one of the ground rules. And I've only been in there for a couple months.
Wow.
So it's a ground rule that basically other people know things better than I do. And I came around to agreeing that she was right because of that was one of the rules, the public humiliation and my own self-doubt. I just all of a sudden said, wait a second, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, how many times during a day do you say, maybe I'm wrong?
Mm-hmm.
A lot. We always do it. We're not sure about
things. It's a healthy mechanism to have.
It's a good mechanism to have.
Yeah.
But they knew that this mechanism can be used against you very much. And that's what happened. And that was the first time I was really gaslighted, heavy duty.
Yeah, it was such a great example of also how you explain the internal process of being like, I know this didn't happen, but I want this to stop. I don't want to be humiliated anymore. And it happened a lot in Nexium where people would give you feedback. And I quickly learned that to defend in any way, even if the feedback was totally off, that if I didn't say anything other than, thank you so much for that feedback, I will go journal on it, or I'm going to go think about that or work on that with my coach. Anything other than that, you were fucked, right?
Also, not only say agree, but your tone had to be in agreement.
Right.
And grateful. Yeah.
Thank you. And sounding like you mean it. So you end up lying in such a, you have to grovel, basically.
You have to grovel.
And that's the only way that works. A lot of groveling.
The fundamental problem with that dogma, because it's not a rule, it's dogma, is that it gives your self-awareness over to someone else. So if you're building your conscious and your own self-awareness, you have to learn to trust the own mechanism of what you're seeing, right?
Correct.
And this basically says, whatever you have going on with you that's well-developed and you're witnessing, you're experiencing, is less valid than someone else's perception of you and your own self-awareness. That's ripe for abuse in any scenario.
Later, you talk about even when you got out, and we all know that you got out because here we are talking, your sense of self was so eroded. You were depressed and you were just lost. And one of your therapists said something about like helping you understand the concept of like principal witness.
Right.
Like basically learning to trust your own experience again, because basically what this did for you 23 years, for us 12 years respectively, is you're saying, I don't know myself. I'm coming to you to teach me how to grow spiritually, emotionally, physically, everything. I'm handing that over to you as an authority because you're a higher rank. And it's so ripe for abuse. And there's nothing you can say. As soon as you agree to that, as soon as you agree to a system, whether it's martial arts, whether it's CrossFit, whether it's yoga, whether it's the military, like any ranking system where the person above you knows better, that's ripe for abuse. And you reminded me of the first time I pushed back on that type of gaslighting was with a woman, fellow green sash, but had more stripes on her sash. And she'd been in there longer and she's a mom and had four kids. So she was like higher rank than me, right? Even though I was a better recruiter, but we're not going to talk about that. anyway, she's in Vancouver and we're supposed to spend time together. And I'm opening a training and her partner was like running the training. And I was like in the center and she's like, I'm in Kitsilano. It's an area in Vancouver. You know, let me know when you're done. And we're like texting. But basically what happened is that like she didn't get back to me.
Right.
So I stayed in the training longer. And then she was super, in my opinion, flaky and hard to communicate with over text, which is fine. And anyway, long story short, I ended up not coming to see her because she hadn't gotten back to me. So I stayed in the training because I guess she's busy. Finally, when we see each other, she launches into me about how I missed an opportunity to build our friendship. By basically not just coming and waiting for her to be done, whatever she was doing, staying in the training meant we had less time together. And I was like, I don't actually think that's true. Our friendship is important to you. And I was waiting to hear back from you. And I didn't hear back from you. I stayed in the training. She just basically gave me the feedback that choosing materialism over humanity and how I would never be a good friend if I couldn't be honest about what I really want. Like, it was this whole fucking bullshit diatribe that didn't resonate in any way, shape, or form to me. And I just said, listen, respectfully, I really disagree. And she'd be like, well, you know, I'm just trying to help you. If you don't want to grow, that's fine. That's okay. Right. You don't have to look at it. And that was something right. that I learned to say that also. Like, it's okay. Like, I'm just telling you what I see. You don't take it or leave it, which was sort of like a softer version of the gaslighting.
But you can give feedback in a loving way.
Like, it's possible.
That is possible. Yeah. But what this gaslighting thing allows people to be mean. Mean people to be mean with the guise of helping you.
Right. And it's interesting, I guess, one way that you could prove all that is when you reconnect with people after leaving mm-hmm. the cult, because those relationships then don't have any of those dynamics of control
right.
and whatnot. And so that you can open up to those people and they'll treat you empathetically like a normal situation. But when you give up your agency mm-hmm. to anyone in a hierarchical situation, even ones that are benign, like college, you know, you give mm-hmm. up a certain degree and you're open to learning and whatnot. And those are benign situations. And it's good for you to be open and accept criticism. But those are benign situations.
Yeah.
And that's a natural good thing. But when you're in a diabolical situation that you don't know about, that you don't know it's diabolical, it's really hard.
It's really hard.
It's really hard.
We even asked people the first day of the 5-day, people would stand up at the front of the room and they'd be like, hi, I'm Sarah. I'm here because someone told me this is a great program and I really want to like get more connected to myself and my goals and like work through blah, blah, blah issue. And then the facilitator would say, and what number are you from 1 to 10? 10 being, tell me everything you see. I'm here to grow. Give me all the feedback. And you're basically giving them permission to do that. One being, I'm just here.
Abuse.
Yeah. One being, I'm here to observe. Don't talk to me. right?
Well, who wouldn't want to be a 10?
Right.
I'm a 10. I'm a fucking 11.
No, it's
give
Spencer.
It to me, Sarah. Tell me.
I also said I was an 11.
Come on. Tell me what's wrong with me. What the fuck is wrong with me?
Every single training, there'd be someone like us who'd say, I'm an 11. Everyone would laugh. And every now and then, there'd be like an 8, a 9, or 10. Never anything less than that. So people are saying, from the beginning, you're the authority. I'm here to learn. I paid money. Give me what you got. Ripe for abuse right there.
Right.
In the wrong hands.
In the wrong hands. Yeah.
You're not signing up for an abuse program and then coming back. You're signing up for people who in the right hands are doing it. You create buy-in. And then whenever people want to abuse that mechanism, it's bound to happen.
Like, I remember giving people feedback in those first 5 days that was really helpful for them. Somebody would deflect with humor and I would pull them aside and be like, look, I see, you know, you paid good money and I see every time we get close to something, you kind of make a joke and you're a bit of the class clown, right? And the person would be like, yeah, that's sort of my shtick. And I'd be like, well, you can keep doing that or you can drop it and kind of we can get a little deeper. What do you want to do? That would be something that I might have said, right? In fact, I remember saying it to somebody.
I did it all the time. I mean, we were always taught to help each other.
Yeah.
And part of helping each other, we had one time where we were encouraged to give 5 critiques to our friends mm-hmm. about their essence flaws. I think you guys had something, an essence flaw also, which was like their biggest weakness and like what all the other problems ran around.
It was called the life issue.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we had that and we were told to tell our friends that was the best thing we could do was basically to give them criticism It wasn't called constructive criticism, it was called criticism. And they had a number of ones for me, none of which are true. But if you say any of these things to me, they pushed a button so hard that I was not in control and was so susceptible to criticism. I'm sure they had them for you guys each.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're human beings. Everyone's got that.
Yeah.
Everyone's got that nerve. That's the human thing.
Right, exactly.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. So things are good. There's all these elaborate parties and you're feeling part of this elite group. What were some of the exercises that were helpful at first? I noted remembering yourself was something that you did. Can you give us a day in the life in the secret group?
A day in the life is a great question because that was the whole point of going to class at night, which was to use the ideas in your life. So during the day, I mean, I was a lawyer. Other people were, they were entrepreneurs, they were brokers, they were this, they were that. And we were told to use the principles of the work in our day. One of the big ones that I loved was this idea of aim. So the idea was that in order to accomplish anything, to accomplish any goal, the laws of the universe were such that you couldn't achieve them unless you did something called remembering yourself. You may accidentally achieve something, but it's not with consciousness. It's not with awareness. So you needed to remember yourself, which I only realized, you know, after I left that it was never defined. There's no definition of it. And when we asked what it was, Fred, the leader, would say, in fact, when he first introduced the idea, he said, what you have to do is you have to remember yourself in order to make an aim. And we would go like, could you tell us what remembering yourself is? Mm-hmm. And he would say in class, he'd say, it's when you remember yourself. And we would say, well, you know, what is that? You know, how do you do that? He said, remember yourself. He put his hand on his heart.
I can totally picture that.
Right. And then some of the older students would say, like if I was asking that question and I was a newbie and an older student would say, Spencer, right now you're not remembering yourself.
I would be like, great, great, we're getting somewhere. So we know what it's like to not remember myself. So how do you know? Let's do the...
Right, exactly. And then I'd say, well, I don't, you know, you're not explaining it. And then another student would say, well, now, Spencer, you're really outside of yourself right now. You're not remembering yourself. And then I'd be embarrassed and I'd sort of calm down and I'd say, I know what you mean. And
right.
So right now I'm just basically humiliated into silence.
Right.
And they'd say, that's remembering yourself.
Because you're present. You're just present. You're just like, here I am.
I'm present. I look present. I'm acting present. They're telling me I'm present. But really what I am is I'm exhausted because I can't fucking say what the fuck is going on because they've shut me down.
Right.
And now I think I'm remembering self. So basically remembering yourself is whatever they tell you what it is.
It's being obedient.
It's being obedient.
It seemed a little bit too like, if I picture the hands on the heart, is like what we call the nexium, like being connected to yourself.
Right.
And they were always saying, it's like pulling from Buddhism and like spirituality 101 and like some, God forbid, like some Osho meditation or whatever. But like they were saying, that's a good thing, right? To be present and to be connected with yourself and your true authentic self. That is a good spiritual practice. But the problem is that they didn't tell you how to do it. So you were kind of faking it.
Correct.
For approval.
Or just to fucking leave me alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, thank you for the feedback. I'll go journal on that.
Remember the one training where we had the experiencer?
Oh, basically like, they had us all in witness state.
I was like, this is fucking bullshit.
I've learned about
it
since.
What was it?
You sit, kind of like a meditation thing, kind of meditate and people would be like, oh yeah, I see that. I'd just be like, get me the fuck out of here.
Spencer, I've seen it in other modalities. It's basically what they call like the witness state or observer state. And they talk about this in other parts of the training too, in Nexian, where like something can happen and you can observe it. Like you're not in the drama of the movie. Like, can you ever seen like a really, right. really sad movie and you cry, yeah. but then you leave the theater and you're okay? Like,
right.
And they would talk about, you can just sit in the theater and eat your popcorn. You can observe it like an observer eating popcorn. So they'd even talk about like eating your inner popcorn. Great tool.
Well, suffice to say, it's a nebulous description.
Well, no, I mean, it's taught in a lot of modalities of different spiritual practices, the observer state.
But like, if you were to take me out of it and isolate us and we were to give Spencer a definition, it'd be two totally different fucking definitions.
Sure. Yeah, they didn't teach it properly and people were faking it for sure.
Right.
My point being is it's related a little bit to what you talked about when they took you to that boxing ring and somebody yes. said that you stop identifying with your body, right?
Right.
So you're like, right. can experience right. pain and like not freak out about it.
I mean, that's a legitimate thing.
Great tool. Great tool.
Absolutely.
Great tool. And I loved all these ideas. I loved my day. I loved trying to remember myself. And I love the ideas of aim. And I love this thing about mm-hmm. not being identified with your body. And who the hell wouldn't want to be in a great state? I
yeah.
mean, it was an illusory thing because they really weren't showing you how to do any of
right.
these things. They were just right. basically criticizing you for not being able to do it. So, huh? I mean, it was just yeah. a mess.
Huh is the right response.
It was a mess.
It grooms you. It grooms you also because when you do the boxing yes. thing and you're able to go through physical yes. violence and then you leave that going, I'm fucking tough as nails and I just did this thing and you're elated on that. Cut right. to like a year later when you're invited to her private ranch for the retreat and you're asked to right. do like really hard physical manual labor. You've already been right. taught like, okay, I'm not my body. I'm not going to identify with this pain. Oh, I right. like I'm hurting from head to toe from doing like a construction job that also you weren't trained for with your soft lawyer hands, right? You know, and then the next thing you know, you're like, oh, but this is an honor because like Sharon asked me to do it, which by the way, huge red flag and number one parallel between Sharon and more so Nancy. Well, Keith too, but like both of them had minions around them at all times, taking care of their every need and, you know, making right. sure that she had the coffee and that her hair was done. And it was a little less obvious than the way you describe Sharon being like brought in on the wooden platform and like hoisted into her lazy boy chair and her vodka right. and her flower. I mean, Nancy had her other thing. There was always a bouquet of flowers.
Really?
Yeah, always
she
a bouquet.
Did?
She always had a big bouquet of flowers and she always had like a microphone and
on
lighting.
Her birthday.
Well, oh, then also, by the way, like I was just laughing about the lavishness displayed to your leader, Sharon, on her birthday. Nancy had the Festival of Flowers where...
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and because Keith had Vanguard Week, which I think everybody knows about, but Nancy had Festival of Flowers, which is a whole weekend where people had to fly from wherever they lived to Albany and spend the weekend with her, and everybody bought flowers. Her whole house was filled with flowers. And I have to say, I'm really proud that I never once bought her flowers. I was like, this is an excessive amount of flowers. Like, I rarely buy flowers anyway, just because they die so quickly. And I think they're expensive. I love them and I love receiving them. But like when I had a baby and there was like four bouquets of flowers, like, oh my God, like it just felt wasteful. You know what I mean?
It does, right.
It's so wasteful. Yeah. And I just was like, this is ridiculous. I bought her other things. I bought her like a fancy $500 leather purse once. Like, you know, people were always trying to get her something that she would appreciate.
When Keith or one of them were in a room, or is there somebody sort of waiting on them and getting them coffee, and were you allowed to approach them? I mean, because like the impression I get from watching like The Vow, I mean, in the beginning, Keith looks like a down-to-earth kind of guy. Like it doesn't look like people are waiting on him or anything like that. But by the end, obviously you think he's like the devil incarnate.
Oh yeah. No, he never drove. There was always somebody driving him. All his meals were prepared. His clothes were laid out and bought for him. Somebody
had his harem.
Yeah, he had a harem.
He had a harem, right.
He had people competing for his attention.
But how about like when he walked in a room?
Yeah, he would walk in a room and people would kind of like part for him to come through, depending on what room it was. Like if it was a forum, which sounds like what Sharon did, this is people asking questions and then people being talked at.
Right.
If it was a forum, we knew that we were going to sit down for a forum and Keith would come, always late, by the way. And I thought he was
right,
late,
exactly.
problem solving the world,
right.
but
that's
he was actually just
too.
Finishing whatever threesome he was
very
just wrapping
one.
Up. So he'd be late. And then people always stood. If it was a formal setting like a forum or in Nancy's case, a coffee talk, you were always supposed to stand if anyone of higher rank came in. And even in my center, like if I came in, a green sash, and I was the only green sash in Vancouver, people were supposed to stand. I did not enforce that. I felt very uncomfortable with it.
Because you're not a narcissist.
Oh, yeah, I hope so. Someone on our Instagram said I was a wee bit of a narcissist the other day. So
oh, like, well, just a wee bit.
I'm a wee bit.
Hey, look.
I'm a wee bit of a narcissist. I don't know. I'm not a sociopathic narcissist.
You're a little bit culty.
A little bit culty. A little bit of a narcissist. I mean, I'm an actor. I think what actor is not a wee bit of a narcissist? But like, as we now know, there's like 52 types of narcissism. And
right, there's 46.
46. Okay. And we're going to have an expert.
There are?
Yeah. There's
46 distinctions, or maybe it's 48 distinctions of the term narcissist. Well, I mean, think about it. If you're growing up a kid, and you're getting attention from everyone, and then you have to divorce yourself from being the center of attention, and you never do.
Right.
Most of us outgrow it at a certain point.
Yeah.
Oh.
So there's that type of narcissism, and then there's like narcissism where like you don't have empathy, and you don't care about other people, and like then you throw sociopathy in there. I mean, listen, I'm not an expert in this, but I've learned a lot in doing these interviews and like post-cult recovery. People throw around the word narcissism or narcissist really way too easily without really understanding the distinctions.
I don't understand the distinctions.
I don't either. Entirely. We're going to actually do an episode.
That's a good idea.
I do on an abusive level, but the lower level ones of like, you could have narcissistic tendencies.
I could be narcissistic. I don't require like everybody to stand up when I walk into a room or, you know, force it upon other people. I just may... talk about myself the whole time and stuff. And
yeah.
It's a spectrum, I guess.
It's a spectrum. Yeah. And, you know, I got in trouble a number of times for not upholding like those rules. Like I remember Nancy came to the center once and she pulled me aside and, you know, gave me feedback about how people weren't paying her and Keith proper tribute at the center.
We got that all the time.
Right? Yeah. Really? Like
at the very beginning, we were told we weren't being nice enough to Sharon. Like there'd be parties, right? And people wouldn't go over to her because they were afraid of her. Mm-hmm. But they were like, afterwards, they were like, where is your respect for Sharon? They sounded like they were kind of nice about it in NXIVM. For us, they were fucking insane.
They never yelled. Anger that in that way would have been a form of reactivity. It would have been something more soft and subtle under the guise of helping you like...
So it was passive-aggressive.
Passive-aggressive, totally. Yes. Like what they'd pull me aside and then say, what does it mean that you're unwilling to make Nancy your priority when she's in town? What does that mean about you? You know,
and you'd have to say,
I have tribute issues. I have authority issues. There's something that I'm seeing in Nancy that's actually within myself that I am uncomfortable with. And I have that thing in the box, they'd call it, like when you're projecting on to somebody.
Right.
Like a lot of people would hear and meet Nancy and be super uncomfortable because she was so expressive. She was like, la, 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 la. And if people said anything.
Yeah, she's nuts.
No, she's nuts. And if anyone said anything, they'd say, well, that's because you suppress
that's
yourself.
Your problem.
You suppress yourself. And Nancy's so expressive. It brings up people's discomfort about how their own inability
she's
to be.
She's inauthentic.
Yeah. She's authentic and you're inauthentic. And because she's so authentic, it's like triggering for you. Like it was always kind of.
Exactly. Out. It's the same thing. I got to tell you, we could have had like a cult exchange program. Like Nippy could have come over to my cult and I could have gone over to NXIVM and we'd have been fine.
We would have had a cult off.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been fine.
The other parallel that I thought was so funny, the way that you described the parties and like the committees that would form to organize the food and the decorations, like this was a thing. For the Festival of Flowers, for the big dinner, and we'd do like this thing called the Follies where people would put on like skits and shows for Nancy and she'd like come in and sit at the front and kind of watch. And there'd be like lanterns and candles and the expense of like, you know, plastic silverware that was silver, like plastic silverware. So it looked pretty still, like, because you can't have that much cutlery for 100 people, right?
Right.
I was like, oh my God, I'm from Vancouver where we recycle like the tiniest bit of paper. And I'm like, oh, this is so much excessive stuff. But the point being is that the lavishness to all of these parties, and it was always an honor. Like nobody got paid for this. There was always what they called like work exchange. And I was shocked by how much free labor Sharon and the leadership got from people who were brought in to like basically build her multiple homes. She had homes all over. In upstate New York, Montana, the Hamptons.
Mexico. The Plaza Hotel.
Oh, and she lived in the Plaza Hotel, which Nippy had to tell me was very fancy because I didn't really know.
Yeah, she had an $8.5 million apartment that was purchased by other people.
And all the participants paid, most of them paid in cash. And she was, I mean, talk about tax evasion.
Oh, yeah. Major tax evasion, which I get into in the book.
Yes.
But basically, half of the money that she got in later years was checks and the other half was cash. They had two sets of books. Sharon, if I could just say this one thing, I mean, she was not nearly as, although I wasn't there in the early days. I think there was much more sexual abuse in the early days. And it was nowhere near on the scale of what y'all people suffered and the victims of Keith Raniere. But Sharon was diabolical, had no problem breaking the law. It just didn't mean anything to her.
No.
When she told people, you know, women in class, you know, she would say, yeah, and it's in my book, if I could just give this one piece, which is always so outrageous and sad to me. You know, I'm ashamed because I'd just watch it. You know, I didn't say anything. But she would say to women, oh, you need to get laid. Now, she spoke like a sailor, which is also, I don't think Keith did publicly, but...
He did. No, he did.
Oh, he did.
Not publicly. He held that off for a while. He waited to some of the trainings.
But it wasn't until the later years in SOP trainings you talk about like...
Right, I saw that.
Men just want to fuck, you know?
I have a theory on that too.
Which is?
Well, the inappropriate behavior is kind of boundary pushing, right?
Okay.
So they're expanding the boundaries of what's mostly uncomfortable for most people to make you neutral to things that normally you're like, hey, I'm not talking about that, in the name of growth.
Right.
Right? So your boundaries are being violated under the guise that, you know, these are important conversations. These are things that we should have. And sometimes they are.
I think a lot of people, when they hear about this stuff, they're like, but how could you have stayed? And they don't understand the level of deep dependency of how the group is set up, so that like your wife is in and you're a lawyer and your top business client is there and like all of your source of income. And it's a really hard thing to pull yourself out of, so that when you see something that's not right, you just learn to dismiss it. You're not even having rational thought. So you marry Beth and she's 42 and she already has two teenage daughters. And then all of a sudden Sharon calls you and says, you know, I don't think that you should have, you wanted to have your own child.
Right.
Don't think that the best should get pregnant because she's older and like the baby might be unhealthy. I think that you should impregnate her teenage daughter, which would have been incest with your stepdaughter. And
right.
Obviously like that is heinous. And you said no, thank goodness. And you were of right mind enough to say no, but like you couldn't wrap your head around that this was like a reason to leave because.
Right. Exactly.
It's all under the premise of, again, she knows better. She's making a suggestion. Thank God you were able to draw the boundary. And she learned that she couldn't do that with you and never brought it up again. But like somebody who's not in a cult might go, but like, that's so gross. Why wouldn't you just leave then? And I think that you said it a number of times, things like this, and I totally relate, is that there's this internal challenge. You wrote, I resented the pressure to do something I didn't want to do, but I also felt guilty for wanting to resist. And I think that's how guilt is used to keep you in line, because you've already bought into this premise because of the hierarchy that you don't know your own self. So if you have that doubt, you feel guilty that you're not like being obedient essentially at all times.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
So I guess my point is, if you haven't gone through that, you just don't know. You don't know what that's like.
You can add a caveat, Sarah. You don't have to know for yourself, experience, to know that it goes on. And if you want any more evidence than that, you can look at the history books. People have run into gunfire for the craziest reasons ever. One of the thought experiments I read in an article one time is, you could have been in pre-Nazi Germany with a 15-year-old kid who in 4 or 5 years was putting another human being into an oven. How do you get to that point?
Right.
How do you get to the point where you're obediently doing stuff like that? So if people want to interflex the front that they're not susceptible to it, well, maybe you're not, and that's great. But there's a lot of people in human history who have found themselves in situations far more egregious than we have, who've been complicit. So understanding the mechanisms of that is important.
Right. I mean, we were victims in very extreme situations, and that's one thing. But Nippy's right. Amanda Montell's book, which is so popular and wonderful because everybody can relate to those sort of cultish institutions that are going on. And
she's great at just making it seamless. And here's how they slip it in. Mm-hmm. Here's how it slipped into your day-to-day lives.
Right. You know, I don't think a soul cycle is malignant. It's a money-making operation. And I actually don't know. I guess it does have victims as well, but it's not the same, you know, spectrum. On the spectrum, it's not NXIVM.
No.
There's more choice, too.
If you look at Stephen Hassan's continuum and the bite model.
Exactly.
There's extreme and not extreme and maybe, you know, less destructive. And that's something we refer to all the time. And it's super beneficial because people might look at something and not know what they're looking at. But now, because of all these books, we have the tools.
We do.
Which is great.
We do. And I want to say to people who are out there listening, you know, to your listeners, that there's no judgment. And that's why I think it's so great that you speak out. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to speak out, is so that other people who are in this situation don't feel judgment about having been conned and duped.
Hey, A Little Bit Culty listeners. Bless your little bitty hearts for helping support this podcast. You asked us to put a link up where you could make a one-time or monthly contributions to help us cover the costs of taking this podcast from our living room to your earbuds. And so we did. And wow, you weren't kidding around when you said you wanted to help this podcast keep on cranking out episodes. You stepped up. Thank you. In fact, in a relatively short time, 70 of you have already chipped in. And together, the whole beautiful lot of you have covered the cost of making almost 5 full A Little Bit Culty episodes. That's pretty freaking good. You are amazing. Did you know that? And yes, we're talking to you, Veronica Wells, Annie Blake, Thomas Wicks, and John Breen, and you, Kenny Bernstein, and Kristen O'Rourke. You rule, Sarah Priestley and Roger Seidman, and you are rad. Andrea Padillas, Helena Durst, Sally Lotz, Joel Blair, and Jolene Bishop. That's just a few of you who are helping to make this podcast happen. Want to make a contribution? Just go to alittlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio. Every little bit helps keep A Little Bit Culty trucking along. Thanks again. We adore you. I'm just going to skim over some of the other red flags I saw. One was the hypocrisy of the anti-materialism bullshit. Like, you know, you can't be materialist and like ribbing on people for being superficial or whatever. And then Sharon is the most materialistic, opulent.
And drinks, right?
And drinks.
Didn't she say she drinks?
Yeah, she was very unhealthy.
She looked it.
That was actually something that I think it was Mark Vicente told me when I left, or Bonnie. Look at what they do, not what they say. So if they're saying one thing and doing another, that's a major red flag.
In life, not just.
Yeah, totally. Right. And the pitting couples against each other, we talked about that.
Reading that, it was obvious to me she didn't like seeing couples happy.
She did not. She liked to make couples, but she liked to control them.
Right.
And being unhappy and, you know, was part of it because only she could make it happy.
Right.
You know, I was in a relationship that, although there was a lot of foundational problems, I mean, there were a lot of problems in it, but we did respect and like each other, but we weren't right for each other and it happened very quickly. She's an excellent person who I care for very much, but we shouldn't have been married.
And she also tried to put gay men with straight women to convert them. Is that right?
Yeah, that's not a very good thing.
No.
She did that to her daughter.
Ugh, there were 3 straws for you that stuck out. Is there any of them in particular that you'd want to share in terms of how you woke up?
So the first one was, as much as we tried, the marriage wasn't working and we decided to get divorced. The day after my ex-wife and I talked about it, I got a phone call from Sharon out of nowhere. And she knew all about this. I'm like, what? And she wanted to talk about us resolving our divorce and wanted us to come up to the plaza and work out a settlement agreement where all these terms would be hashed out. And that's when I kind of was like, wait a second, this doesn't sound right. I mean, it didn't sound right to me when she suggested incest. Okay. But I was too like in a coma.
Yeah. You were in a hypnotic trance from what I can see.
I mean, I didn't do it, obviously. And it wasn't something I was even thinking about. And I pushed back. And I am sure she recommended that and things like that to other people because she did have other people get into, which I describe in my book, into impossibly ridiculous situations that were immoral, illegal. But that first straw was when she insinuated herself into my divorce and wanted to set up a custody situation that would have been basically taking my son away from me. So that was straw number one. The other straw had to do with my business. But the third straw was now that I was kind of waking up. And by the way, what the cult taught us was that we needed to wake up. That's why it's so funny, because we were actually going to dead sleep. But when I really saw what the hell was going on there, I just saw Sharon treat someone like she normally did. But like the anesthetic was worn off and I could just see how cruel, how mean she was. I'd also met a woman who I revealed my secret to. I had never told anyone for 23 years that I was in this group. And somehow when I told her about it, everything changed, you know?
Mm-hmm. Broke the spell.
Yeah, broke the spell.
But that's true that you said, never hadn't thought about it, that in many ways your dependency is a collateral because it's what's on the table. Like if I leave, my photos could be exposed. If you leave, you're going to lose your business. So it's leverage.
And not only that, I had this emotional belief that, and they did this to you guys, my success, all the good things in my life were a result of what I got in school. They called my cult was called school. Everything that was fucked up in my life was my problem.
Because of you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so without them, I wouldn't have good things and I'd be fucking my life up, which by the way, it's the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to see that.
Well, which leads us really well, Sarah, if you don't mind.
To the Garfunkel?
Garfunkel?
Garfunkel paradox.
Yes.
I read that and you put language to things in a different way that I hadn't yet. Do you mind explaining that?
Please. Yeah, sure. So the Garfunkel paradox is the belief that your best days are behind you when in fact your best days are ahead of you. And when I got out of this cult, I mean, the cult made you feel that if you were leaving, you were almost like committing suicide. And they made you feel that those who left were killing themselves, killing their possibilities. In fact, I used to have dreams about people. I had some of my best friends in the world in the cult, and they left, and I couldn't communicate with them. They were cut off. They were outcasts. They were in the wilderness. And I'd have dreams of them being dead.
Red flag.
Red flags all over the places. We haven't even talked about all these red flags, have we? But
no.
In any event, the paradox is exactly that what the cult teaches you is wrong. It's the exact opposite. That's what a paradox is. And so why do we get the name Garfunkel? Well, it comes from Simon and Garfunkel. And in the therapy sessions with my psychiatrist, you know, I would lament, you know, my business career was over because I was in a relationship with my business partner who stayed in the cult and we broke up, that I was kind of like Garfunkel, that he was like Simon, Paul Simon, and I was like Art Garfunkel. And when they broke up, you know, Paul Simon, he could go on, you know, he had all these hit albums and whatever. And then Garfunkel, you didn't really hear about anymore. You know, he didn't have any hit albums. I mean, he didn't play guitar. He didn't have anything, you know, and he was only lucky to be in Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, he was really just the second of the other singer. So my psychiatrist saw what was going on and he let me come to it on my own without telling me and by asking a lot of questions, which I describe in the book, but that's not true. I mean, Garfunkel was and is a beautiful singer who, in fact, Paul Simon looked up to as the superior singer. He sang their most beloved song, Bridge Over Troubled Water. It was written for Artie Garfunkel to sing. So it's a paradox. They both went on to, you know, wonderful careers afterwards, and they were just different, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He basically turned around, my psychiatrist turned around my thinking. So that's the Garfunkel.
That was great. I really like that part.
Good, good. I'm glad you like
it. Yeah.
I go into my therapy because he really helped me a lot. And I don't know if I would have made it without that kind of help because of suicidal ideations that I had, which I needed to address. And if anybody has them, they need to address that.
Important.
Because it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you and I had talked about this when we were chatting on the phone, that I'd heard you in another interview saying that you didn't think that cult survivors needed a cult therapist, to which I said, we'll discuss on the pod. It's a discussion that at a point where I disagree just from my own experience, but then I hadn't got to that point in your book. And I think that the person who you worked with did a great job, specifically that they'd had trauma experience.
Yes.
Or experience with abuse. And really that's the key thing. Having someone who's cult aware, cult educated, it's a whole other level. And I just shared that, like, you know, for me, talking to people like Roseanne Henry, who we're going to have on our show, and Dan Shaw, who we already did have on our show, who are cult experts, who'd been in cults, really, really helped me, right?
Yes.
But I also had a psychologist I mentioned in my book in the acknowledgements, Dr. Noah Susswein, who was not cult aware at all, but was a great psychologist. And even from that perspective, asked me great questions because he really didn't understand. He's like, but wait, so like as an example, like, so you're taught that you only need food and shelter and water to survive and everything else is a desire. But what about things to like thrive, like connection and community. I'm like, oh my God, that's it. That's why the women were miserable in Albany, because they weren't thriving, because they were taught that anything other than like survival needs was unnecessary. And they felt guilty for wanting a career or wanting a relationship or wanting to have a connection because it meant that they were deficient and then they had to go spend $1 million on EMs. So my point is just to backtrack, like my experience was that I needed a cult therapist and a regular psychologist and a couples counselor, which Nippy and I have now and we love, who doesn't have any cult background either. I think the most important thing is that you feel safe.
Correct.
You know, and you feel not judged, and that you find somebody who will help you with whatever you need to be helped with. And it's going to be, like Nippy always says, it's case by case. The main thing I think that's problematic when people go to a therapist after they've done something like, you know, your work and our work, doing the work,
right.
is a personal development. So it overlaps with a lot of therapeutic languaging, right? So when you sit down in front of a psychologist who doesn't know NaxEM or doesn't know, how do you say it? Gurdjieff. Or doesn't have that background, and they may say something like, but what do you mean, love? And I'd be like, you can't ask me a meaning question.
That
fuck.
Was the same thing.
Right?
I was like, don't say that. That's like, and he would have to like jump around.
Yeah.
But that's so true.
Yeah. So that's a real problem. People who come out of a personal development, therapy-based, spiritual, whatever cult, and they go to a psychologist and they may ask those similar questions because, again, so much of our work was stolen from legitimate work and legitimate modalities. So it can be triggering. So I think those are the things that I'd want our listeners to know.
Well, also, I think if the therapist can recognize they're looking at abuse, the sooner they recognize they're recognizing an abuse in any way, the sooner they're going to help you.
Correct.
That's where I think
that's
it's
exactly
applicable.
Right.
That's how they figure out, like they'll ask you questions and they'll figure out, oh, this guy was abused. Now they have something to work with. So if they're not
correct.
A cult expert, they're trained to do that and hear the abuse. And that's where they can reintegrate your thought, I think.
If you're listening to this and you're in a small town and you really like your psychologist or therapist or counselor or whatever, and they're willing to educate themselves, give them Take Back Your Life by Yanya Lalich, Combating Cult Mind Control by Stephen Hassan.
By Stephen Hassan.
And Terror, Love, and Brainwashing from Alexandra Stein. And maybe one of Dan Shaw's books about narcissism. And I think you're going to be fine. Like those books will bring people up to speed, not saying don't get certified. But a lot of people are going into different educational programs about coercive control and like psychotherapy with a background on cult education. Like this is changing right now.
We had a therapist, and this is one of the things that she was saying. She's like, you look at these dark people, these narcissistic, these people, they had a certain way of getting into people's psychologies years ago that have been kind of outed in a lot of degrees. So what she said she was seeing a lot of is a lot of them seeping into the spiritual world or the personal professional development world as a means to implement their abuses. So they've now poisoned a kind of domain where the checks and balances aren't what they were, and they get away with nebulous language, not defining their terms and everything. And they seep into these things that are supposed to be beacons of good and everything. And then that's how they twist it. She said she was seeing a lot of that particularly because it's getting harder to do. And now you have the internet, right? So now they're going to have to adapt, right? Like these people are the kind of people that sit around and think of ways to do this. So now that they're getting this pushback and people are talking about it more, you're starting to see people in positions of power being outed with these behaviors. The consciousness level ideally is going to probably gonna get worse before it gets better, but it's probably hopefully going to get to a certain point where we can see it so they don't thrive, and then they'll adapt to that and however that works.
Exactly. It's just like, you know, you build a better lock and somebody else knows how to pick
there
it.
There you go.
It's the same thing.
You could have said that and I wouldn't have.
No, I liked how you said it. I'm just repeating what you said. I mean,
that's
I liked
it.
How you said it.
That's it.
It's good to speak to someone who is qualified.
Yeah.
To talk to people in bad situations. And there's a range. I mean, I don't think I would have gotten out if it weren't for having read Rick Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a situation where I needed real medical help also. But I think reading about cults is damn good because like you said, you had like an aha moment when somebody gave you one of these things. I'm sure you did too, Nippy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just say, oh, wait, that was Sharon. You know, it all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm for all for the education.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think Hassan or somebody said it should be taught in schools, or did you? Somebody I was reading.
Nippy's been saying that for a while.
Yeah.
I'm with you on that.
I think cult education, hopefully in the feedback we're getting, seems to verify this, but like through the podcast and, you know, all of these books. I mean, I'm 5 years out feeling pretty great. And then I read your book and I'm again, having, you know, having more awarenesses of, and memories too. Cause like, you know, when you're in right. that trance, whatever you want to call it, state where you're just shutting out reality to make it work, right? To get the dollar back, to get your investment back, you miss stuff. You're using a different part of your brain. So like you said something about like how you woke up. And I remember something I shared with Nippy last night. When we were waking up, like it happened in stages, right? Like we were going to get out and then right. we're like, we can't just leave. Like we have to tell people. And then it was like, we can't just tell people, we have to dismantle this, you know? And somewhere in there, I reached out to Nancy to talk to her, right? And I left her a message where I was like, okay, so I have Keith's initials on my body and your daughter did that to me and we need to have a discussion. And I was upset, but I left her a voicemail and she never called me. And I found out later that she didn't call me and she played it for a number of people and said, why would she call me since I was so angry? So she didn't call me because I was so angry. I don't think I've ever said this publicly because I kind of forgot about it, but I was the golden child, right? Like I called her my bonus mom. She called me a bonus daughter. Michelle and Lauren were like sisters, you know, in that way, in terms of like, I was elevated, had an elevated position. At certain points, I was one of the top recruiters, not the whole time I was there, ran one of the most successful centers. I'm not trying to pump my tire. I'm trying to say like, I was an asset to the community and to her company.
Well, it would have been a good business call.
It would have been a good business call for her
even
to
if you didn't exactly. care about her.
Yeah, to at least right. call me and try right. to figure out what had happened, like why she wouldn't say, oh my goodness, you're hurt? Clearly there's been a miscommunication because I actually don't think that Nancy,
she's been desensitized.
Well, she's like been desensitized else, and she, you know, right? she'd been, you know, whatever too. But the point is that like, I think it's good that she didn't call me back because had she called me, she may have been able to try to work it out and like it may have stayed internal, right. you know? My point being is who knows? She may have been able to keep a lid on it to the point we didn't go to the press or didn't go to the New York Times or, you know, whatever. So it's actually good that she didn't call me, but like, you know, bad business move on her part to pick up the phone.
Could she have talked you out of it if she called you back?
That's the thing. I don't know.
Here's what I think. She didn't even know it existed. So I don't even think she...
She didn't know what she was looking at.
What she was trying to talk her out of.
I see.
Either way, she should have called to check up on me, is my point. Yeah. Like, given our relationship and what everything I'd done for the company, it's just absurd that like, and look at right. that's a huge red flag. A normal person would pick up the phone and be like, whoa, 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 what happened?
Oh, you know? I see what you're saying. Yeah. I completely get, all right, so I had a similar experience. Yeah. I was in trouble. They were fucking with me. I was having big problems in my business, big problems. And I reached out to Sharon and I said, I'm having some problems here.
And she said, I don't give a fuck.
And she said, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing as you had.
It's kind
of the
same
thing. That's what reminded me. That's what I'm telling you. That story in your book reminded me.
It's unbelievable. What's the story? It's so similar.
It's so similar. It's a gift. Like to write a book like this, to put yourself out there, to be out for public scrutiny is a gift for you to do it. And
yeah, by the way, very brave.
Very brave.
Thank you.
And it makes me feel, given that we both come from this similar background, that we should be true essence friends now. Actual essence friends. I know.
But since you're joking.
I know, sorry.
You are my essence friend. And Nippy, you too.
Thank you. I don't know what that means entirely, but I'm sure we'll find out.
It was just a word that was used in both of our groups, you know.
You know, look, here's the thing. My psychiatrist said this when I would jump at certain words, he'd say something and I'd say, oh no, we can't use that. It was a cult word.
Yeah.
And then finally he said, you know, think about this. I'm not saying we should. Think about it. You know, he's a nice Jewish guy and understands neurotic people like me. So he would say something like, he'd say, think about this. You know, there is such a thing as co-opting a word. Like, for instance, the LGBTQ community, they use the word queer. And that used to be an insult to gay people to be called queer. Now they've adopted it. If you remember Obamacare, they used to say that as a slur to Obama, and then he started using it. It was like gone, you know, it had no more power. So I'm happy to be your essence friend.
Okay, good. We can co-op that word. We'll take it right back.
I have one final question writing the book. I think you end one chapter. It was about you wanting justice.
Right.
To me, that's one of the things in this whole entire experience that I've really felt motivated towards is justice. Talk to me about like the desire for that, the origin of that, and why.
It's just my personality. I mean, I became a lawyer because I care about justice. I felt like I let people walk all over me for a long time. And then I realized like I spend my business career fighting for people to get justice. as best as I can. And the best thing I could do for myself is to get justice for myself. So my mission has been to get justice for myself and for everybody else that's in there. It's very, very hard to get people out of that cult. Mm-hmm. They will not take your phone call. They don't read anything.
If they were to listen to this podcast or someone send it to them, what would you want to say to them?
Well, it's so much. I guess one thing I would say is, do you really think the leaders are your friends? You know, ask them for something that you really, really need and really, really want and see what they do and see what happens and see what kind of excuses they give for not doing it for you.
Yeah, ask them something that inconveniences them for you.
Right. I have managed to get some people out. Actually, I have a blog.
That's great.
Cultrevolt.com. And some people have gotten out from that. And a few of them, they're like my best friends now.
That's great.
We joke, you know, and it's great. And it means a lot to me to have done that. And I guess the other thing I was thinking about, you know, the best thing, they're very, very secretive. Nobody has written a book about them. The blogs that have been out there about them, besides mine, they're all anonymous except for Esther Friedman. People are just afraid. They're afraid to have their name out with this group. I wanted to lead the way and kind of be like a Me Too that other people from this group can speak out. And I hope when the book comes out that people will step up and say, hey, this happened to me too. And the more people do that, the hopefully it will shut them down, because I'd like them to be shut down, but they're not. Even though Sharon died, they're still very much around.
I find that so hard to believe, given how potent she was. Yeah.
Well, let me just ask you a quick question. There are still true believers in Nexium, right?
Yeah. I mean, less than 20, as far as we know.
Okay.
But I don't think it's like they're continuing the school. They think they're fighting for justice in a different way.
Yeah.
Spencer, thank you for writing this book. Thank you for getting out. Thank you for sharing your story, for fighting for justice. We need people like you. It's a pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Spencer.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees. High above you, the air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like, is offered purely as commentary, because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, you are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A Little Bit Culty loves you. Okay, guys, so I hope you get a chance to read Spencer's book. I think you will all love it as much as we did. But before we send you on your merry way, Nippy, do you have any word salad for us?
Yeah, Spencer gave me one that someone in his school used to say.
This is specifically according to Gurdjieff's Apostle Ouspensky.
Yeah.
This is Nippy sharing an email from Spencer referring to Fred talking about what Ouspensky said about Gurdjieff. Okay, go for it.
Here we go. Okay. In order really to observe oneself, one must first of all remember oneself. Try to remember yourself when you observe yourselves, and later on, tell me the results. Only those results will have any value that are accompanied by self-remembering. Otherwise, you yourselves do not exist in your observations. In which case, what are all your observations worth? Thank you, that'll be $5,000.
Word salad. I love your word salad, and I love you.
I'm deuces.
Have a great week, everybody. See you next time. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO.
If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.